You're listening to Culture and Ecology, stories from the Confluence, hosted by Chelsea Peel and Rick Rolfe. For more information, check out our websites and join us on Patreon. Get in the know, stay in the flow.
Over the past several years, urban areas in the western states have experienced devastation from wildfire. As fire season approaches again, it is important to question our cultural relationship with fire. In the Willamette River Valley and other areas like it, Native people historically applied fire intentionally to maintain ecological conditions of the oak savannas that characterize the valley floors. Low-intensity grass fires prevented succession of shade-tolerant coniferous trees from overtaking the oaks, encouraged regeneration of vegetation in the understory, and increased availability of plant food that wildlife depended on. Since acorns and wild game were among the most important subsistence foods for Native people of the region, applying fire in this way ensured their livelihood. Now, however, urban and industrial elements tightly constrict the use of fire. The application of controlled burns in and around urban areas are now rare due to risk of severe damage to social infrastructure. Without regular low-intensity fires, shade-tolerant trees are overtaking the oaks, wildlife habitat is becoming depleted, and the risk of uncontrolled, high-intensity wildfire is increasing dramatically, along with the threat of catastrophic destruction.
As urban and industrial infrastructure continues to expand, application of fire becomes increasingly complicated and constricted, but not impossible. In this podcast, we speak with Mark Hedrick, who served nearly 20 years with the Nature Conservancy as preserve steward and fire manager. His experience managing prescribed burns, including one in the Rogue River Valley, demonstrates that with careful planning, fire can still be applied to improve ecological conditions and reduce risk of catastrophic fires, even in overgrown and developed areas. Along with this, he shares his experience using fire to regenerate vegetation and wildlife habitat. His story offers hope for our modern relationship with fire.
I am currently the site and facilities manager at Playa in Summer Lake, and prior to that, I spent close to 20 years with the Nature Conservancy as preserve steward and fire manager and caretaker of the research station. And I had put in for a seasonal job there in 1996, the summer of 96, and didn't get that. But then the person who took the job decided he didn't want to spend winters frozen and snowed in at SICAN, and so he left. And then the job came open, and I applied and got the job, and kind of took a right turn or a left turn, however you want to look at it, and changed my life for almost 20 years.
You were just burning right outside here. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so on Tuesday, we're burning. I went essentially as a member of the RFPA, so the Summer Lake High Desert Rangeland Fire Protection Association, a rep to help Marty St. Louis out at the Summer Lake Wildlife Area here in Summer Lake. And so he's doing a burn and is still going on to basically regenerate goose and duck habitat in the Gold Dike impoundment area. And he's done that. He's been here for almost 30 years, and this is his third entry, as they call it, into that area. And so it's removing cattails and old tule growth. So that it's basically what they call decadent, you know, and it's stuff that gets so thick, there's so much senescent growth or so much senescence, the dead material that ducks and geese won't nest in it anymore. So you burn it off or you graze it off or mow it off or whatever, and it regenerates it so those birds can get better feed and will nest in it again.
Can you tell us a little detail about how fire actually contributes to this regeneration for habitat?
Yeah, so most of the West has evolved with fire, and so you've got pretty much every habitat from the Oregon coast all the way to the Rockies has evolved with fire and needs fire, really. And, you know, for 120 years, we've been putting fires out, and we've really changed forests especially, but also our rangelands too, by not allowing fire into those. So when you put fire back into those systems, you're basically burning up dead and down material. You can use it to kill trees if you want. What we were doing out there was burning off the old, the tules and cattails and the senescence, which is just dead material, to then get new growth to come up and provides better food for the animals, for the birds out there. And it's not just the waterfowl. Lots of other birds will benefit too by removing some of that material. So you'll have shorebirds and all kinds of different birds, sparrows and things that will benefit by that burn also.
One of the more interesting subjects for me is that we haven't been burning, as you said, for 120 years and that these ecosystems really thrived on fire. Can you tell me some of your experiences where you've seen what happens where basically we don't have the opportunities to burn?
Sure. So that's pretty much any of the big wildfires that have gone on in the last, say, 20 or so years in the West. The big ones, you know, we've had several 500,000 plus acre fires, which historically was not the case. You know, fires most often burned low to the ground and burned slowly. And occasionally you get pockets where things were a little thicker that would burn a little faster and burn more intensity and severity. But for the most part, fires didn't do that kind of thing. And so basically what we're trying to do by burning is what you call resetting the habitats, the ecology, to take it back to what it was prior to Europeans coming and basically stopping fires from burning, so putting fires out.
And you had some experience working in the Willamette Valley?
Rogue Valley. A little bit in the Willamette Valley in oak habitat, but same kind of thing. I mean, every place I burned pretty much when I worked for the Nature Conservancy, we got those memorandum of understanding going between the Nature Conservancy and Oregon Department of Forestry and Forest Service, and in some places, Fish and Wildlife, where there were refuge areas. And so sometime in the early 2000s in the Rogue Valley, a contractor came into the Agate Desert Preserve and burned, and they basically lost the burn, burned up some of the neighbor's land. The smoke covered, there's a at that where the Agate Desert is, just south of Table Rocks in the Rogue Valley, there's a junction of two pretty major roads and a lot of traffic going through there. So the other thing that he did was allowed the smoke to cover the road and had no traffic control. And so they basically had to stop the traffic on the road all the way through rush hour. So I was approached by the ecologist in probably 2004 or five and was asked if we thought that we could write a burn plan. And along with just writing a burn plan, it was also trying to show the local fire district, so Fire District 1 and Oregon Department of Forestry, that the Nature Conservancy could handle a fire, again, prescribed burning on their land. So I made a couple of trips over there. I had a contractor I worked with all the time, Pacific Fire and Habitat at the time, and he came with me and we looked over the burn. He was my holding boss on most of my fires. He came with me and we looked over the Agate Desert Preserve and said, yeah, we can do this. You know, this is 52 acres, piece of cake. We burned 500 to 1,000 acres at Sycan almost every year together. So that was a small burn. And even though much more urban than what we were used to, still thought it was doable. After a couple of trips over doing a recon, then we looked at maps and start to map out what we could do as far as boundaries, so control lines. Wrote the burn plan, submitted it to Fire Department 1 and Oregon Department of Forestry, and then also we had a fire manager for the Nature Conservancy out of California at the time that would review my burn plans also. So once we got all the signatures on those plans, then we went back over and walked around the burn with Fire Department 1 and Oregon Department of Forestry, and just kind of gave them our plan, talked to them about our experience, you know, having started back in 1984 with the Forest Service, and Gary Robinson with Pacific Habitat and Fire started in the probably early 80s, maybe late 70s, and was a smoke jumper and firefighter and then had his contract company for quite a few years. And so based on our experience and a pretty solid burn plan, they gave us the go-ahead. And so at that point, then it's just basically looking at the weather and one of the big things that you have to do over there, and this goes for the Willamette Valley, lots of places where you've got more urban settings, and especially in the case of the Agate Desert, you had a VA hospital nearby and a respiratory center. So you really want to make sure that your smoke is punched out. So, and what that means is there's a volume for amount of smoke that you can put up in the atmosphere. And if you get the right conditions, the smoke will basically, the heat from the smoke will just punch out any, if there's any type of an inversion layer, and it'll go up and it hits what's called the winds aloft that can be up around 14 to 20,000 feet. And when those winds catch the smoke, then it's going to carry it out of that basin. And that's what we were looking for. So we just, once we had the plan and had the signatures and everything, then we just started planning out, you know, okay, we know we're going to do this in the fall. And my usual time to burn up at Sycan was usually early October. And so I was hoping we could get this burn done beforehand. And it was going to be just a half a day, you know, a half a day to a day burn. It was a small 50-some acres, not a big deal. So then we just kind of waited for the right conditions. And when we had them, just, you know, we tried to predict a week out that we were going to get those conditions. And when we did, I just started calling up everybody and saying, hey, let's get together on this day. If things are a go, we'll light the match and we'll burn it.
I don't think a lot of people understand exactly how difficult that situation was. You know, when you talk about the urbanization, the closeness to the hospitals, the crowdedness and so forth, could you describe just a little bit about how difficult it's become to burn in these kinds of areas, Rogue Valley, Willamette Valley, other places in Oregon?
Yeah, and there's lots of things going on there. So Wildland Urban Interface, the WUI as it's known, is one of the big things. And so you've got people are moving further out into the rangelands, out into the forest, into the woodlands. And you've got to worry about, you know, if you lost a fire prior to all of that, it jumped into the neighbor's land, but it was, you know, grazing cropland, not a big deal. Now you've got to think about keeping the fire off because you don't want to burn somebody's home up. And then along with that, you've got what are called smoke-sensitive receptor areas, SSRAs. And those are pretty much any urban area. Lakeview, Oregon is one. Klamath Falls is one. Pretty much any city in the Rogue Valley and the Willamette Valley, the Oregon coast, same thing. Almost any city of any size is in an SSRA. And you cannot put hardly any smoke into those areas. And I don't really know the numbers right offhand, but you've got to make sure that your smoke is carried up and out of the atmosphere or up into the upper atmosphere and carries off of the area. So because at night, regardless of where you burn, at night when the air cools, the smoke is going to drop back down. And so if your smoke doesn't carry out of the area, it's going to go up above your burn, and then it's going to drop right back down at night, and you're going to be in trouble the next day because you smoked out an SSRA.
I'm curious, have you seen any other burns like this? From my perspective, they seem very infrequent, that people just simply aren't able to pull these burns off, but you did.
When the Nature Conservancy was trying to burn in the Willamette Valley, it was even tighter constrictions on burning there because you've got more population, you've got a river that flows down into another river, which is going to carry, the smoke is going to want to drop at night down into the Willamette and then eventually into the Columbia, and you could end up smoking out Eugene and Salem and Portland and all kinds of places with the smoke doing that. So one of the burns that I wrote a burn plan for was in an oak area, and so this area had been taken over by other plants, other trees, mostly because it had not been burned. It just, you know, things came in there and nobody was going out thinning. It's very expensive to do mechanical treatment on any land. It's often quite a bit cheaper to burn. So if you can just go in there and burn, you can, instead of, you know, $5,000 an acre, you might get away with $500 an acre. And those are just, you know, wild figures, nothing to quote on me on there. But it's really, that's one of the biggest things is trying to get things done with all of these constrictions on them. Well, the oak burn that I'm talking about, we had to worry about the fire getting outside of our boundaries. We were up against power lines. You can't put too much smoke on power lines. Again, you've got we had the Willamette. I don't remember the small creek that was on this burn, but you had to worry about the smoke dropping into that because there were houses all along sides of the creek, and then that flowed down into the Willamette. So we had to make sure that the smoke lifted and basically went up over the Coburg Hills is where we were at. And it needs to get up into the Coburg Hills so that it can then be carried out.
Can you share some of the secrets why it was successful? What were some of the keys there?
Working with the local folks, both the preserve manager and the preserve ecologist, and talking to them about what the winds were like, when was the best chance for us to get those conditions that would allow the smoke to carry out of the area. Talking to the local fire guys, the FD1 and ODF, those folks also had some institutional knowledge that stuff is just priceless. When you've got somebody who understands how fire works, and being able to talk to them with my contractor I used and convincing them that we knew what we were doing, we'd successfully done much bigger burns in the area on the preserve where I work, Sycan Marsh, that was key also. And then making sure that sometimes when you get everybody together on a burn, you know, and you decide that morning, you know, say you've got 20 people out there and you don't want to turn everybody away and say, sorry, we can't do it today. But it's much better to do that than it is to light the match and have the smoke either drop onto the two roads, you know, that cause traffic jams, or to smoke out the VA. So it's something my boss told me at the time. You know, I was pretty upset one time when I wasn't able to get a fire going. And he said, hey, you know, he said, that's great. You know, saying no is just as good as saying yes, because that tells me that you know what you're doing. You know when to say no and say, yeah, it's not good today. You know, we were lucky. We planned that burnout in the Agate Desert. It worked out just perfect. You know, I mean, we couldn't ask for better. The two guys from FD1 and ODF came up and shook my hand and just said, beautiful. You know, that just textbook. It was amazing. So
we've talked a little bit about why fire is important for waterfowl regeneration habitat. Can from your experience, can you tell us why fire is important for trees, for other animals, and for humans?
There are so many reasons why fire needs to be in our systems, and it's why we need to overcome all the things that we do, you know, the SSRAs and just all these, and the WUI problems and things. But so up where I was burning at Sycan Marsh, one of the big things up there that we were trying to regenerate was bitterbrush. Persia tridentata is a plant that deer rely on to get them through the winter. So they did not winter up there, but they would start their winter off by eating that bitterbrush and then moving down into the summer range, like down here in Summer Lake or Silver Lake, and they would continue to eat that bitterbrush, and that's what got them through the winters. There have been a few papers written on it saying that, yeah, fire does a pretty good job, but nobody really had any long-term data on what fire can do, especially in a very wet system like Sycan Marsh was. You've got 22,000 acres of marsh, so there's, you know, there's water right up to the edge of the forest, and up into the forest quite a ways was a pretty moist system. And that bitterbrush, turns out, responded really well to burning. You wouldn't get that same response down here on the desert in Summer Lake. The bitterbrush that grows down here does not like to be burned. It burns, it doesn't come back. But up there it did. And when we look at the veg at the bitterbrush, the first year we had a pretty good, at one of the big burns we did up there, the first year after we put those plots in, we burned, we had a pretty good winter and a pretty wet spring. And so we got pretty good response out of things. And the bitterbrush put on about 10 inches of growth that first year on the existing plants that we burned. And we started to see a bunch of new shoots. And by the time we did the five-year plots, we went back in 5 years post-burn, we were seeing, I don't remember the exact number of the percentage of increase, but I want to say it was about 60% increase on the bitterbrush within those plots. So it did respond really well to fire. And so that, short story long in this case, that's one of the things that fire does. So in lodgepole areas, the lodgepole in this area doesn't need fire to reproduce. The lodgepole in most other areas, like in Yellowstone, the cones, the seeds of a lodgepole, it has a waxy coating and it needs fire to reproduce. The one here doesn't need that. And so when a lodgepole cone hits the ground, those seeds are going to sprout. And if you don't have fire in there or you're not doing some mechanical thinning, it's going to take over pretty quick. Lodgepole used to be kind of kept into the low, colder areas. They like these frosty pockets. Well, when you take fire away from it, it starts to spread all over the place. It just regenerates really well. And so if you can keep fire back into that system, you can thin those thickets out, and they will get just to the point where you can't walk through them. The great thing about ponderosas, and that's, you know, our forest here on the Fremont Wainema, is it's mostly ponderosa with pockets of lodgepole. Ponderosa loves fire. It's got a big, thick bark on it, and it can take a lot of fire and not damage it. As long as it doesn't burn through over a certain percentage down to the cambium layer, it's going to survive. But yeah, like I said, to start this one, there's so many reasons why we need to get fire back in the system and try to overcome all these obstacles. And thinning out fire or thinning out forest with fire can open it up to where deer will move back in there. We stopped logging here on the Fremont Wainema for the most part in the 80s. And since then, the deer populations have started to drop off. And a big part of that is because this forest is so thick, our mule deer do not like that. They like a much more open forest. And so you keep fire in these areas and you're able to thin the trees out with, whether you're doing mechanical to begin with or just doing applying fire, you can thin it out and improve the habitat for mule deer.
Just for our listeners, I'm curious why having mule deer in the forest is important.
Well, it's part of a healthy ecosystem. So they've been here for, you know, tens of thousands of years, and people here love to hunt them. Mm-hmm. You know, we get people from the Willamette Valley and from Idaho and Montana and all over coming to Oregon to hunt our mule deer. And they used to be a big thing. We're not, you know, now if you ask somebody where you're going to hunt mule deer for the big ones, they're going to go to Colorado or they're going to go to Wyoming, because we just don't have these big monster muleys that we used to.
So outside of hunting, isn't it also about just the ecology of the apex species in this area? Is that still?
Yeah, absolutely.
Making sure.
Yeah, and that's, you know, whether people want to hear it or not, when the mule deer are there, they're food for the apex predators. So we don't have grizzlies here, but we do have a few wolves, and we've got cougar, and they definitely will eat them. And that keeps them fed.
The other question I had is about these plants that aren't available without fire. Have you come across other plant life, either cultivated or not, that need fire for regeneration, or maybe even first foods were connected to some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So purple camas, that grew up at Sycan, we found great response with fire with that. And in fact, you could walk out onto the meadow swales and some of the other, there was six different habitats, I believe, at Sycan, and the camas grew in the wettest areas and the low spots, and we were starting to lose that with a lack of fire up there. And camas was used by the Native Americans, in this case, the Klamaths and Paiutes, more than likely. And I don't really remember exactly, but they would pulp the tubers, the roots, and make all kinds of things out of it. So it was very important to them. And Wokus, if an area dries out, the wokus will, you can burn that and it'll regenerate it quite well. Same kind of thing up there. And I don't have any numbers on this because I didn't put plots into the marsh. Unfortunately, my plots were just in the forest area, but out on the marsh, just anecdotally, we could look out there and see that we were starting to lose wokus in the low areas that would dry out in the summer. And when we'd burn through those, the next year we'd see some pretty good regeneration. And there's quite a few others around. Bitterroot is another one that likes fire. I don't know if you'd say it's, you know, fire dependent, but it definitely likes fire and will expand.
how can people be involved in making sure that fires continue to get burned in a prescribed way?
That's a really tough one. I think one of the things I tried to throw out to people all the time was, you're going to get some smoke in the fall with your prescribed burns, but it's better than smoke all summer long by these massive wildfires. And that's really tough for people to understand, because they're thinking, okay, I just went through 3 months of smoke in the summer, and now you're asking me to put up with another month of smoke in the fall. And that's only one aspect of it. you know, I can totally understand somebody who's got a beautiful home out in the woods. You know, they don't want to see prescribed fire out there, because all they think about is all the bad ones, because that's what hits the news. You know, we worked as hard as we could to get the good word out. It's like, hey, we just burned 1,000 acres. We burned 800 acres, you know, and it was all kept within the boundaries. And here's what it looked like before. Here's what it looks like now. But educating the public is so, so hard. It just most people don't understand fire, and they have just an inherent fear of it. And so that's something I don't really know the answers to that. You know, all I can say is we've just got to keep showing people when we have good prescribed burns. And wildfire, too. I mean, wildfire is a good thing. It really is. If we don't have it, we end up in the situation we are. And that's something you've got to tell people. Look, there are times when we're going to have to let wildfires burn. And right now, the only place that really happens is places like Bob Marshall Wilderness and Yellowstone, these huge areas, you know, that you get a fire that's 20 miles back in the backcountry, people are like, yeah, you know, don't care if that burns, but starts getting close to my house, I'm going to get upset. You know, I want you to put that thing out. And putting in control lines is something else, you know, that if you can get that done, and some forests have been able to do it, but there's so much NEPA and EA and all that stuff. And not saying that's a bad thing. I totally think that those are good things, but you've got to go through so much red tape to get a control line put in. And I'm not talking about a 4-lane highway. I'm just talking about a road that you can run off of and let a fire burn up to, or fire off, you know, back to a wildfire to control it. But yeah, that's kind of the a few of the points that. But I just think you really need to show people that we can do prescribed burns, we can control them. You know, really push the good ones, the ones that don't get out of control.
Just for the record, I want to rephrase part of what you just said, which is that the good fires are underrepresented in the media. I think that's a really important note for future development.
Absolutely.
So have you been able to sort of observe, maybe anecdotally, cases where places that you've burned have been reseeded versus areas that have not been reseeded, and maybe speak about some of the differences in those two?
Yeah, so one of the big issues there is seed bank. So there's only a few places around the West that'll grow plants out or grow seed out. So you say there's some specific plant that you want to grow that grows on Sycan Marsh, and so you want to go up and you want to harvest that. Well, then you take that to one of these folks, and they grow it out and get seeds from it. And it may take 5 years to get enough seed back to go out and seed an area. So that's very expensive, pretty time-consuming. And some plants just absolutely do not regrow like that. They need to, the seeds need to germinate in the ground out there in the wild. You know, if you, it's certain things like bitterbrush, it's the only way to get it to grow is to grow plants up. And they usually get 6 to 10 inches tall, and then they go out and actually plant the plant like a tree, like a ponderosa or something. But you don't grow it by seed. Wildflowers, for the most part, you know, the forbs and things grow pretty well off of seeds. But my take with the Nature Conservancy, for the most part in Oregon at the time, and my boss, my supervisor at Sycan Marsh, was definitely of the opinion that the seed bank is there and all we need to do is burn and give it the right conditions and it will come back. And we saw that for the most part, that the natural regeneration was much more successful than in areas. And it wasn't a direct correlation, because we didn't actually try any seeding at Sycan Marsh, but places where I've seen it happen, it definitely is a little, is more difficult than natural regeneration.
That's really wonderful, interesting information. And just for our listeners out there, you know, when you say these seed banks, I know a lot of people might not understand the volume of seeds that we're talking about. We're talking semi-truck loads full of seeds, one after the other after the other. So it is an incredible investment to produce that much seed.
When I first started, there was this thing called the Triple F Fund, and basically Reagan had put that into effect in 1980, and it was bottomless for wildfire. It was like, if you need to fight fire, here's the money. Well then, after Reagan, and I think it was H.W. Bush that started pulling money out of that and saying, oh, no, you know, we can't spend all that money on fire. You got to have it for, and totally agree, you know, we need to do other things, you know, especially things like forestry and maintaining roads and stuff. But then it became a point where they started robbing from those funds. So there wasn't any money left at all for recreation and for forestry and other stuff because they had to. They're like, well, you know, you want us to stop in July putting fires out? We need another $10 million or $10 billion or whatever dollars. And so they would just take it from all the other parts of the Forest Service and BLM and everybody.
What would you like to see in the future to improve conditions for operators and for the forest and the ecosystem?
One of the biggest things, I think, is small diameter material. What do we do with it? So you've got trees that are not merchantable. They're not going to turn them into, you know, old growth is gone. That we know that's not going to be a thing, but you can still make 2x4s and 2x6s and all this kind of stuff out of trees. And anything that's smaller than that, you know, so a lodgepole or a ponderosa or a white fir or whatever that isn't big enough to turn into a 2x4, what do you do with that material? And the problem is there's these boundaries that they put on, and I think it's 75 miles now. So if you have to haul material out of the forest and it's more than 75 miles away to the nearest processing plant, it's not cost effective. And it's been years since I've checked on that number, but that's one of the biggest things is what do we do with that material? We can't just, you know, you've got these masticators that go out there and they just chip everything. Well, then you've got 6 inches of chips on the forest floor. And when a fire goes through there, it may not roar, but the residence time is going to kill that soil. That fire is going to sit there and smolder and for days, if not weeks, in that chip material, and it just kills the soil. The soils become anaerobic. Water runs off them instead of soaking into them. It won't grow anything. A seed can't catch. And then there's chip plant places that you can take it and make chips, you know, for making particle boards and OSBs and things like that. There's hog fuel. But if you can't afford to haul it to those plants or to this biomass plant, you know, that's making electricity out of it, what do you do with that stuff? And if we could find a use, and I just, as from what I've read, nobody's really looking into that. You know, you'll hear Wyden and these guys, you know, our senators every once in a while talk about a little bit, but I don't think a lot of money's being put into it. And we have to. I mean, in the West, it's if we don't figure out what to do with that small diameter material, we're going to lose all our forests. There's not going to be anything left to to turn into lumber, or it's going to be all burned up.
Huge business opportunity.
Mark, is there anything that we've missed? Anything that you'd like to share?
I tell you, it's been a great career for me doing this. I was so fortunate when I first started out with the Forest Service in 1984, working for a guy who loved to prescribe burn. We pulled off 1,000-acre burns with 4 people back in those days. You can't do that today. I mean, just the OSHA and the review process wouldn't let you do that kind of thing. But if folks are given that opportunity to understand and to learn about prescribed burning, you know, from a fairly early age, I was 22 when I started out, and it was just, it's amazing what you learn, you know, and what you can pick up. And you don't get that in 1 year of fighting fire or working on a prescribed burn crew. I mean, it's the same thing that we're fighting with today with the RFPA, with the Rangeland Fire Protection Association here in Summer Lake. We just did this burn for the wildlife area. I was the only person from the RFPA there. You know, I've got probably 10, 12 young folks around here that I would love to get out on the fire line, you know, to see that, to learn about prescribed burning, to learn about, it helps you understand fire better. And it's, you know, it saves lives. It's not just learning. It's, you know, if you understand fire, you're going to be in a lot better shape. But I think if we could carry that, that education that I got to the general public and just teach them, you know, how fires work and how prescribed burning can rehabilitate forests that have just gone decadent, you know, with the overgrowth and the dead material in the grounds. To me, that's, I don't know how to do that, but I think if we could, that would be, you know, huge to get people to understand.
You're speaking the language of my heart here. You know, and on the subject of ecological regeneration, one thing that we often overlook is actually regenerating the workforce, regenerating the knowledge. And so exactly like what you're saying, with the loss of actual activities and opportunities to burn, we are losing the technology, the information, the skill set, and the expertise. I think this is incredibly important.
That's cool. I'm imagining a master's, like master gardener program, but a master prescribed burner program as a way to connect, especially rural kids, you know, that are have more of a stake maybe if their families still have land.
I like it.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks. Enjoyed it.
You're listening to Culture and Ecology, stories from the Confluence, hosted by Chelsea Peel and Rick Rolfe. For more information, check out our websites and join us on Patreon. Get in the know, stay in the flow.